Hello, and welcome to this edition of Criminal Mischief, the Art and Science of Crime Fiction. I'm D.P. Lyle. As you know, this is live on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and I appreciate them for hosting this show. Today, I want to talk about the elements of a thriller. What makes a thriller thrilling? There's a lot of discussion out there about what makes a thriller, what makes a mystery. I think they all fall under the large umbrella of crime fiction. You know, there's cozies, there's historicals, there's all kinds. But what is the difference between a mystery and a thriller, if there is one? I mean, they both involve crimes and puzzles and action and heroes and villains and all this stuff. And they all have beginnings and middles and ends and inciting incidences and turning points and three-act structures, if you believe in that, and all that stuff. But what's the difference? I'm not sure that the line is very clear, but to me, a mystery is a puzzle that needs to be solved by the protagonist. Maybe a cop, maybe a private investigator, it may be your sleuth that has no relationship to crime at all, just gets involved in this crazy situation. But the point is that the reader gets the information at the same time the protagonist does. So they don't have knowledge that the protagonist doesn't have. And that is what the mystery is. Let's solve this together. This is one of the reasons first person is so good for mystery novels. A thriller, on the other hand, I think the reader knows things that the protagonist does not know. That's the thrill. That's the danger. Don't open that door. Don't go down that hallway. No, don't go look for this guy by yourself, you know. And if you walk down a dark alley or go down in a basement, you deserve what happens to you. But in thrillers, it happens all the time. But the point is that the reader knows things that the protagonist doesn't. So this makes first person a little tricky unless you use some combination of first and then multiple third for other characters, which I do in a lot of my stories. I think James Patterson did for years and was quite successful with it. So I think it works. But you have to give the reader superior knowledge. That's the thrill. So one of the things that people always talk about thrillers is they open with a bang. Well, not always. I mean, they can. They can open with a bang. They can open with a young girl swimming in the ocean and a shark attacks her. I mean, that opening scene to Jaws was just, wow, you got to be kidding. In The Terminator, they can open with this, the naked governor of California coming out of this fireball and then ripping a guy's heart out to steal his clothes. And we're going to talk about that in the next show where we do an autopsy on The Terminator. I'll talk about that later. But they can open with a bang. They can open with an explosion or a car chase or something that happens that's very dramatic and very visual. Remember all the James Bond stories, not only the books, but the movies? They always started with this crazy thing, James Bond getting out of some tight situation. And you think they're showing me the end first? No. That was actually the ending of James's last episode. And then he goes and sits down with M or Q or whatever, and he's handed another assignment. So Ian Fleming was smart enough to start with a wild, crazy story, but it was actually the climax of another story. And then we start with James Bond in his real world, getting another assignment and peeling back the layers of that. So that's a great way. But it can also just start more calmly than that, but set a tone and a mood and a feeling that, oh, if you remember The Godfather, it opens with Brando in his office and it's dimly lit and it's dark and you can tell that the guys around him are very deferential to him because, well, he is the Godfather. And there's this very mousy guy in there asking for a favor, asking for a revenge, asking his daughter has been assaulted by these thugs. And he's asking the Godfather, you know, Don Corleone, will you help me? You know, my daughter, she's, you know, oh, please, please, you know, and he's a mousy little guy. And what does the Godfather say? He says, I'll do you this favor, but I may call upon you in the future. and I may ask a favor, and you cannot refuse me. Uh-huh. So now we've started the story, and we've established the genre. We've established who this person is. We've decided the power of the Godfather. I mean, here's a guy asking for help to get some guys beat up, and which does indeed happen. But here's the price. So we set the stage for what this story is going to be all about, and we did it without blowing anything up or any car chases. And it brings up the other thing. You must establish the four W's, the who, what, when, and where, quickly. In The Godfather, you know, we kind of know this is New York. I mean, it's the mafia, it's all that. Now we know who we're dealing with, the Godfather and his minions and all the people around him. The what, well, this is going to be a story of crime and family and all of this, because you see all of that very quickly in the beginning of the book and the movie and everything, the wedding and all that stuff. And the when, well, you can tell by the dress and the cars and all that stuff very early on that this is many, many decades ago. So you establish the four W's very quickly. In The Terminator, it's established because it's Los Angeles, it's present day, it's sci-fi, it's this, all these fantastical things happening. In Jaws, what have we established? That it is present day, that it is a beach community, that we quickly see Brody as the sheriff appear because the body's found of the young girl, or at least the partial remains of the girl that was attacked by the shark, and suddenly his world's turned upside down. So we have this inciting incident, and then we show the world as it is now before it gets knocked off balance by the inciting incident. So what do we do after this scene? Well, the Godfather's taking visitors who are asking favors or giving, you know, him praise or whatever, and a wedding is going on. How much more natural and normal could it be than a big Italian wedding with the food and the drink and the dancing and the music and all of that? And so we see the normal world that surrounds the Godfather, but the undercurrent is that there's something going on. So we establish that with the Terminator. Once we get the Terminator and Reese on the scene with the fireballs, and I said we'll go into this more detail in the next show, we see Sarah at the cafe where she works, the burger joint, Burly Burger, and we see what a ditzy little blonde she is. So it's the normal life, but we know her life's getting ready to spin out of control. We know that Michael Corleone, when he shows up in The Godfather, we know his world's going to spin out of control. And we know for sure that Brody, the chief of police at Amity, his life is going to get completely bent out of shape. We know that. Another great beginning was Silence of the Lambs. If you remember, it started with Jodie Foster running through the forest. Well, we don't know who she is. We don't know why she's running. We don't know anything. But, I mean, it sets you on the edge of your seat, because here's this young girl who's running by herself in an isolated area. What good could possibly come from that? Well, it turns out she's an FBI agent, and she's in training, and et cetera, et cetera. And so we see her normal world. She's trying to be in the guy's world. She's trying to be tough. She's trying to become an FBI agent. And then she gets called into Crawford's office, and it's like, wow, I want you to do this. You're going to go interview this guy, this Hannibal Lecter guy. And that changes her whole world. So in each of these cases, the inciting incident, Jodie Foster, the Clarice Starling, she's sent to talk to Hannibal Lecter, which changes her world, but it also gives her a chance to rise up the food chain. So there's stakes here. There's needs here. There's wants here. Brody, his world's getting ready to go sideways. So the inciting incident, after you have something that is exciting, or ask a question, and then you set the stage for how the real world exists, and now you throw a rock in the pond, and you create waves, and you ripple the real world. And so now you establish the story question. Will Brody find and kill the shark? Will Clarice Starling be able to use Hannibal Lecter and track down Buffalo Bill, the serial killer that they're after? Will Michael Corleone become who Michael Corleone was supposed to be? Will he evolve? Will he be able to avenge the attack on his father? Will he be able to avenge the murder of his older brother, Sonny? Does he have the tools to do that? In The Terminator, will Sarah Connor survive this unrelenting attack on her by this creature, this thing that she doesn't understand? And so the whole middle section of the story then are these questions and the things that arise. So in Jaws, first of all, this young lady is killed by a shark. So what's Brody's reaction? He's going to close the beaches. Well, not so fast. The town council, the mayor and all that, the smarmy little guy, say you can't do that because this is the 4th of July weekend coming up and this is where we make all of our money and the whole island needs this to survive and yada, yada. But, and so he somehow gets the coroner to say, oh, well, it was a boating accident. And Brody says, why didn't you say that in the first place? So now they shut down the idea of closing the beaches. Brody still feels uncomfortable about it. So we've got a situation where there's been a shark attack. There's a conflict between Brody and the powers to be, and now the coroner, as to what really happened. And Brody still has his doubts. Okay? So then who shows up but Hooper? And he's from the Oceanographic Institute, and he's a rich kid with a nice boat, but he is an expert marine biologist. So he comes in, and they go do a little autopsy on the fish, and that supposedly ate a boy, which was what changed everything. Suddenly there's a second attack. This young man has been killed, and now they got to close the beach, and the conflict between Brody and the city council becomes even greater. And he's starting to question what the heck he's doing there. He doesn't like water anyway. It's an island. I remember his wife said, why would someone who's afraid of the water be on an island? He said, it's only an island if you're on the water. Otherwise, it's just land. And so Brody has this fear of water, and now he's got this second killing of this little boy. And the mother has slapped him on the beach, a great dramatic scene, saying, you know, you knew there was a shark in the air. Why didn't you close the beach? Well, you know, how are you going to explain to a grieving mother, well, the city council overrode me and all that stuff. So he and Hooper go and open up the shark that was caught, supposedly the one that killed the little boy, but there's no little boy in there. And Hooper finally convinces him, look, you got a problem. There's a shark out there. It's a big shark. It's not going anywhere. It's got food in the water. And if you don't kill it, you're not ever going to open the beaches. So they hire people to do it. And here's where Quint comes in, and he's crazy. And what a great, 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 great character played by a great actor, Robert Shaw, just one of the great characters in all of movies. And so, all these people, these goofballs go out and try to find this shark. But then there's another scene where the shark comes back and hits somebody else. And as it heads over around under the bridge of the pond, Brody's son is there. And the shark comes right at him, but thankfully goes underneath him and heads on out to sea. But that changes things. And there's a very dramatic moment there where Brody, after he's sure his son's safe, turns and looks out to the sea. That is the epiphany. What happens in thrillers in this middle section is that one problem after another is thrown at the protagonist, and they use their old ways to fix it. Brody's going to close the beach. He's going to hire someone to kill the shark. All these people are going to come in and go out and try to kill this shark. All this stuff's going to happen because that's the usual way of doing it. But at that moment, he realizes these aren't going to work. These aren't going to work. They're going to have to pay Quint his price. He's going to have to, because he's the expert, and Brody's got to go with him. He must confront this himself. And that's the epiphany. So now, rather than reacting, he becomes proactive. He becomes part of the problem. We'll see that in The Terminator when we go through that. In The Godfather, Michael is kind of peripheral. He's seeing all this stuff go on. His father's been attacked but survived. Michael sneaks into is in the hospital, and he sees bad guys coming to get him, and he hides his father away from so that he saves his life. Sonny gets ambushed and killed. Suddenly, their whole world is under siege. Michael, who has always been outside the family, the youngest son, the one that went to the military, the one that does not want to get involved in crime and has avoided it and has sat back and watched all these things happen, suddenly realizes his epiphany is that he has to fix this. He has to save the family. He has to protect their reputation and their power. He has to avenge his father's attack and his brother's murder, him. And him alone, because he's capable. He's military trained. He's good with guns. He can do this. He's focused. He's smart. He's tough. And the great, great, great scene when they're all in there, the Robert Duvall character, Tom, who's the consigliere, and so there they are sitting there in the room, and Michael said, "Set the meeting with Salazzo. I'll go. You hide a gun, I'll get the gun and I'll kill him and a New York cop that's protecting him." And at first they laugh and think he's crazy. "Are you out of your mind? You've never done anything like this. What are you talking about?" But something about the way Michael said it, they believed him, and he does. So he becomes proactive. He becomes proactive. In Jodie Foster's character in Silence of the Lamb, what happens there? She has a first meeting with Lecter, and it doesn't go well. He manipulates her. He's smarter. He's more clever. He basically abuses her, and she leaves with her tail between her legs. But the next time she goes back, they have this exchange, and it's brilliant. Two great actors sitting there but across the bars from each other, having a back and forth that is absolutely brilliant. And now she's holding her own. Now she's realized she can't just react to what Lecter is doing. She can't just react to what Crawford's making her do. She has to become actively involved. She's the one that has to solve this problem. She's the one that has to save the senator's daughter. In other words, save the lamb of her childhood. She had to figure all of this out. And she's the one, it's fallen on her shoulders, and she has realized that. That's her epiphany, and that's her turning point. So in each of these scenes that go on in this section, you have a lot of options when something happens as to what the outcome of that scene is going to be. So let's say your cop is going there to arrest a suspect that has a warrant that is in a home. And he goes there and he knocks on the door. And he says, "Is Joe here?" And they say, "Yeah, he's right here." "Joe, you're under arrest." "Oh, okay." Joe stands up, turns around, he puts the cuffs on him, takes him out to the car, and he's arrested. Well, that's kind of weak. There's no tension there. I mean, sure, Joe got arrested and they're going to take him downtown and interrogate him, and the story may move forward from that. But he goes there, he knocks on the door, says, "Is Joe here?" No, "Joe's not here." "Do you know where he is?" "I don't know where he is." Well, that scene is actually a little bit better, because now he's still got a problem. He's still got to find Joe. Joe's not where they thought he was. And so now they got to go find Joe. So we've still got, he got frustrated. A roadblock was put up in his way. The information that he had that this is where Joe is located at this time is faulty. Okay, so let's go back to square one. Let's keep looking for Joe. What if they said, "Okay, is Joe here?" "Yeah." "Well, he's under arrest." "Yeah, okay, fine, but he ain't going to go easily. He ain't going to go easily at all. You're going to have to go extricate him from the back room. It's going to be a knockdown dragout because Joe ain't going nowhere. Oh, and by the way, he's got a gun." Well, wow. That's yes, Joe's there, and yes, you can arrest him, but you got to go through a lot of crazy stuff to get there, and are you willing to get into a gun battle or whatever is necessary in order to get Joe? And the fourthly is, no, no, Joe's not here. He's not here at all. So you can't arrest him. Oh, by the way, Joe's at your house. He's kidnapped his wife, your wife and kids. So that's no and furthermore. And that's by far the best answer, because now you not only haven't solved the problem, the protagonist hasn't, he hadn't arrested Joe, he hadn't found Joe, but oh, by the way, now he's got information that Joe has kidnapped his wife and kids. That raises the stakes tremendously. One of the other great concepts is, I call it convergence of time and space, or life in a trash compactor. In other words, your options keep shrinking down. We'll see this in the Terminator. It is fantastic. So what happens in Jaws? What cuts off the time and space requirements for Brody? Well, first of all, they go out there, they shoot these barrels in this shark, and this shark is pretty smart. He keeps following them. He keeps banging the boat. They put all these barrels in him, and it didn't do any good. They keep popping up. They keep popping up. And now Quint, who is the guy who knows more about sharks than anybody on Earth, is saying, I've never seen one swim with three barrels like this. This isn't possible. So you can start seeing things aren't going well. And not only that, not only has Brody left the security of land and the whole island, now he's on this little boat and he's in the middle of the ocean and he's got this predatory shark that three barrels won't bring down circling the boat. So his world is getting smaller and everything they try doesn't work. And now suddenly this shark attacks the boat. It damages it severely. The boat's now sinking. So now they only got half the boat. His world is shrinking more and more and more and more. And then Hooper goes in and goes underwater and doesn't come back up. And he thinks, well, now Hooper's dead. And then Quint gets eaten by a shark. And now Brody's by himself in a boat that is underwater with only a mast sticking out. And this shark is circling him and coming after him. So you can see how his world and his options have absolutely contracted the convergence of time and space. He has no more space to run. He has no more time to solve this problem. And he must figure out how. Well, remember, they foreshadowed earlier when he untied some tanks and they fell all over the place. And Hooper said, hey, be careful of those. They'll explode. Well, Brody remembered that. Brody had a rifle. Brody was able to blow up the shark. But he had to do it on his own, which brings up another thing. In a thriller, the jeopardy needs to be personal. It's not just the cop solves the crime. It's not just they find the poison in the tea. It's not just they arrest the guy and take him to jail. There has to be a confrontation. And the protagonist has to be able to lose something very, very important, usually his or her life. If not, then the life of someone very dear. But there has to be a personal loss. There has to be personal jeopardy. And at the end of the day, it must become mano a mano. They must fight hand to hand. In Brody's case, it was the shark. He had to kill the shark. He did. And we'll get to the Sarah Connor thing when we talk about the Terminator. In Silence of the Lambs, wow, what an ending. She goes, they're gone. Most of the FBI are off on a wild goose chase at the wrong place. She's figured out where Buffalo Bill must be. She goes and knocks on the door, and lo and behold, it is Buffalo Bill. And lo and behold, he's got this catacomb of hell that she has to go down into. Oh, and by the way, he's got night vision goggles, and she can't see her hand in front of her face. And she's got to confront him in this small room in the dark. So her space has literally contracted to inside her head. She can't see anything. She is absolutely panicked. And so her world has contracted into this dark basement with this maniac who she knows has no brakes, will do whatever's necessary. So this is convergence of time and space, and she must confront him face to face and win. That's what makes thrillers great. So we have to start with a bang or a story question or something that says, huh, whoa, what's going to happen next? And then we have to set the stage for the real world the way it is now. And then we have to have something that knocks the world off balance. And now our protagonist is trying to get the world back on balance by answering the question, will they be able to accomplish this? Will they be able to survive and accomplish this? And then all the middle section is all about winning and losing and winning and losing and winning and losing. And at first, using normal things they've used all the time to solve problems, either ignore them or get someone else to do it or let nature take its course or whatever, or use all the little usual things. But something happens about the midpoint of the story where they realize none of this stuff's going to work, and now they got to go proactive. Now they've had an epiphany. I must go solve this. No one else can. And then at the end, they have to run out of options. They have to be cornered, as it were. Those make the best thrillers. And then they must confront the bad guy mano a mano. So that's kind of some of the high points of what makes a thriller a thriller. So when you're writing your stories, think about these things. Every scene has to answer one of those questions. Yes, no, yes, but, no, and furthermore. And the tension must rise. And pay attention. I think it's very important to that middle point. All the things the protagonist does beforehand are like they did things their entire life. It's like they solved problems their entire life. But there comes that moment about the midpoint of the story where they realize none of that stuff's going to work, and now they have to become aggressive and creative in order to answer the story question, will they do this? Will they survive this? Will they get to the goal? So that, to me, is a very, very critical part of thriller writing and storytelling, is that pivot point in the middle of the story. So think about all of that and think about these things when you come to your stories. As I said, I wanted to tell you this first. There is one book and one movie that every thriller writer should read and see. And the book is Red Dragon, Thomas Harris. It's the original introduction to Hannibal Lecter. It's the first of the trilogy, really. The movie on that was called Manhunter, I think, with William Peterson, who of later of CSI fame. The Red Dragon that was redone later is fine, but this one was the real deal. This one followed the story. But read that book. It's a textbook for thriller writing and hits on all these elements. It's on all these elements. And the movie is The Terminator. It's probably the perfect thriller. It was done so well and hits on all these points and has one of the greatest character arcs probably in the history of movie making. And next time, what we're going to do is do a scene-by-scene autopsy of Terminator. So if you're interested in that, you've probably seen the movie, you might go out and pull it out and look at it again, and we'll talk about it next time. So that wraps up this session on the elements of a thriller. This has been DP Lyle. I hope you've enjoyed your visit here at Criminal Mischief, and until next time.